You are listening to Tech Reads, interviews with emerging technology thought leaders. Our sponsor is Softech, the premier technology trade association that has been serving northern Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County since 1997. Our mission is to create Softech moments where people connect, explore ideas, and create new business opportunities. Learn more at softec.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Brian Schwartz from Softech, and you're here for another exciting episode of Tech Reads. This is actually episode 24, believe it or not. And I'm very excited today. We have JC Chamberlain joining us from Virginia. He's visiting, and he wrote a book called Antidote, A New Emotional Wealth Framework to Build Resilience. So we're going to be talking about that. We also have Bob DeMuschel here as the president of Softech. Bob, do you want to say anything about Softech before we get started?
Softech is really designed to create Softech moments. And Softech moments are events that instigate that ignite a conversation within the community. And that's our core mission of what we do.
Yep. And we were just telling AJ, who's joining us remotely, that if you have a special interest group that you'd like to start, reach out to us. We have office hours here in San Luis Obispo where we meet, and we have conference rooms available to support these special interest groups. So if there's anything that you want to explore with others, this is the place to do it.
We also have the same in Santa Maria community. And
that's right.
Down there, we're doing like Idea Lab and biotechnology and cybersecurity and those types of topics. So the program exists in both of the communities.
Yep. And also joining us is Kevin and Rick. Thank you both for joining us. And there'll be some open Q&A here, but to get started, JC, why don't you just give us the real high level overview of what Antidote is and what inspired you to publish it?
Sure. Antidote is an emotional wealth framework that gradually revealed itself to me because I was hit by a car going 55 miles an hour. And
on your bike?
On my bicycle. And I was thrown 100 feet, and I wound up in an ER. I woke up in an ER, and I was paralyzed. And there was a guy holding my left hand that I'd never seen before when I woke up. And I struggled with that because he was holding my left hand, and I was not able to hold it back in return. It's kind of a natural tendency that we have if someone's holding our hand to want to give that back. And it turned out to be the driver who hit me. And it transformed my whole journey to realize that he had done the right thing to come to the ER, to follow the ambulance. And, you know, he was the first person that I saw when I woke up, aside from the surgeon who was stitching up my chin and my forehead. And so that was the beginning of a journey where I discovered that there was already love all around me that came through these different elements that emerged as the emotional wealth framework.
Okay, and you've had a few more setbacks in really the last, 15 years. Maybe talk about your cancer journey as well.
Eventually I recovered and I learned to walk again. And I was able to get on a bicycle again, and they had predicted that I would not ride, probably would not ride again, but that if I worked very hard, I would be able to walk. And so it was a couple months after I got that news that I got on an indoor spinning bike. And I certainly felt like an uncaged bird when I was able to get back on, you know, something with eventually might have two wheels. And over the next several years, I learned to ride again and gained enough confidence that I could ride on my own again. And then about 5 years into that recovery journey, I was diagnosed with a very aggressive prostate cancer. And I learned that I had already developed this network of things, this framework of things that supported me through the recovery from being hit by the car, that I chose to bring into play to help me address going into surgery and then coming out of surgery and recovering from prostate cancer. And people encouraged me to tell that story, and that's eventually what wound up becoming the book.
And I mean, you were so these you've had setbacks and things that you've overcome throughout your entire lifetime, starting very young. And we were talking this morning a little bit about, you develop resilience as I wouldn't sort of a superpower, but from a young age, your mom instilled in you the importance that you are resilient and that you needed to have that to survive in the world. Maybe
Right,
talk a little bit more about
right. I
that.
think from a very early age, she, in moments when that called for reassurance, my mother was fond of saying to me, "Don't worry, nothing is going to be okay." And it's easy to be a skeptic of that kind of commentary when you're 5 years old, but gradually I realized that she meant it. And once you make that kind of paradigm shift, I think when you understand that the world is going to dish up a life to you where things are not going to go your way, it changes how you approach the world. And her goal was ultimately for us to be maybe on the overprepared side for life, right? We needed to be above and beyond what we needed in order to get through life to just be okay. She wanted us to excel. And she was a person who wanted me to know 7,000 words before I was 7 years old. And standing on our 10th floor balcony, looking out at New York City on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, we surveyed a lot of humanity from that viewpoint. But her comment to me was, there are only 500 people on the whole East Coast of the United States who are leaders. And she said, you are one of those leaders. No pressure, 5-year-old, right? But that's the culture that I grew up in, was that almost to a degree that whatever I did, it wasn't enough. And so I think I became competitive, and maybe ambitious is the right word to say, because she instilled in me a certain mindset from the very beginning.
Did you feel like you were called out? You were unique from that perspective, and that you just had to always rise above the circumstances that you were given
You
as a
know,
leader? Or, I mean, from the
you know,
early
I
days?
think I grew into something from an early age. When you present kids with wooden blocks, they'll do different things with those wooden blocks. But in my kindergarten class on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and in public school number one, which is where I went to school that age, we had these blocks, and I became the master architect of a skyscraper that I had my kids, that I went to school with. I had them build it, and I instructed them to, how I wanted to look, the on-ramps to the skyscraper, and how the skyscraper should be structured. And I realized that later on, it really became a pattern for me that I wanted to be kind of at the front of the room, giving people, whether it was inspiration or leadership, that fell to me. And that was something that repeated itself a little bit later on in life also.
Yeah, I mean, so you could argue the nurture versus nature. You were born leaders to the extent that your circumstances, your environment fostered that. So it sounds like your mom was really pivotal early on in sort of instilling that. So there was some nature, but it was mainly nurture that she expected that from you.
Right, she did have
And is your
expectations.
brother in the same boat?
Yeah, he knew at age four we would sit side by side reading the Time Life series. They had a whole series of books, and he really loved the book on medicine. And he would read it to me, as soon as we could read books together. And he said, "I'm going to be a doctor," and he knew that at age four. And I'm sure that he had his own commentary with my mother about, what did he want to do? What did he want to be? And I think she nurtured that, and she helped us dream big when we were very young, about what it was that we wanted to be. And I knew that at that same age that I wanted to be an architect of some type. And you know, what I could see out the window of my 10th floor bedroom in New York City was the Empire State Building. So that was the paradigm that I grew up in, you know, from a very early age, was that there are skyscrapers around me. And so that was what I imprinted on, was that. And my brother has now, you know, been an obstetrician for 35 years. And he was a leader in his field with hormone replacement therapy and lectured all over the world. And I think I witnessed that, you know, in his own life. As a child, my parents published a marriage enrichment manual together. They conducted, you know, seminars in churches all over the state of Ohio. And my father was a published author at an early age, you know, when I was young. And then he continued to publish throughout his career. So for me to write something and publish it, I'm not going to say it was necessarily an expectation that that would happen, but it was certainly okay to have that expectation that maybe someday the outcome of my life would be that I would write something.
Well, and you've done it later in life, but under a lot of wisdom, earned experience. You know, you knew what you were talking about at this point. So the wealth framework, there's basically seven aspects to this, and you sort of created this methodology or model, if you will, to get help people grasp them. So why don't you touch on each of the seven frameworks kind of in your own words and how they all kind of come together?
Sure. I really started out as six, and I had this eventually revealed to me. But it started out from my experience in Boy Scouting, where kids would come to me and they'd say, "You know, I really want to be like you, Mr. Chamberlain." And I said, "Well, the goal is not for you to be like me. It's for you to be the best version of you." And you know, they would say things like, "Well, what do you mean by that? What does that look like?" And you know, over time we would build a trust relationship, and kids would come to me and they'd say, "Boy, I really want to go to this concert, but my parents are saying no." And I would say, "Well, how is your emotional bank account with your parents?" And they would look at me like, you know, with a blank stare. "What do you mean by that? What's an emotional bank account?" And I said, "Well, do they trust you to care about them, to be responsible? These are things that we teach in scouting, but how's your account with your own parents?" And so gradually I would explain to them that it was like a savings account. You know, you have a savings account, you earn some money, you save it, it earns interest. That's a dividend. And so that grew, that concept grew into the network of the eventually had to figure out why it was that I survived this terrible bicycle. You know, I was hit by a car going 55 miles an hour. I was on my bicycle, and somehow I survived that. And so I was searching for why it was that I survived this accident. And honestly, in the ambulance, you know, I had a face-to-face with the higher power that was, I didn't need ears or a mouth to have this conversation. And it was just an extraordinarily clear communication with God. And I was welcome to ask anything. So I said, "Why me? Why this? Why here? What do you want from me?" And God said, "There was a fatal accident in your future that only I can see. And because I'm not done with you, I chose this accident because it's survivable, but it will change the course of your life so that today is not that day. And the fatal accident will no longer be in your future." And 90 minutes later, I woke up in an ER. And there's this guy holding my hand. And on the other side, after the surgeon finished sewing up my chin, I could see my girlfriend standing there, and she was holding a sponge to my lips, which was all I was allowed to drink. And I looked up at her, and I was in a neck brace. So I realized right away something was wrong. You know, why do I need stitches? Why am I in a neck brace? And so she said, well, you were in a bad crash with a car, and you're now in a hospital, so you're in a safe place. And the next thing that occurred to me was, is my bike okay? Because that was something that my mother always asked when we would crash. She would run to the bike and she would say, is the bike okay? Because she knew that if the bike was okay, I could get back on it and I could finish the race. And this was what drove her, was to finish and to be the champion. And that crashes were something you could sort of expect in life. But if the bike was okay, you could finish. And so that became my paradigm. Initially, I got back to her and I said, I think I know why I survived this. Here are the six elements of a framework that I think helped me survive this. And the first element was health. So by building a deep well of health, we have this incredible resource to survive something. And you have to work at that. Obviously, it takes sacrifice to have to build muscles, to build endurance. And so from an early age, I was kind of a sickly child. And I had rheumatic fever when I was age 4. And by age 6, they said to me, you have a damaged heart valve. And so you're not going to be able to do sports. So when you're 6 years old and somebody tells you that you're not going to be able to do sports, that's kind of a crippling commentary. And all I wanted was a baseball and a glove and a bat. You know, I wanted to, the thing that I couldn't have. And so gradually I realized that I could do something else, right? So I kind of pivoted from that situation, which was a bad situation for a six-year-old to hear that you're not going to do sports. So at age 7, I dragged my parents to the orchestra demonstration at my, that was at the local high school, but of course I was in elementary school at the time. And I begged them to buy me a violin because that was the thing that I really wanted to do. I wanted to play the violin. And they said, well, we're not going to buy you one, but we'll rent you one. And so we rented a half-size violin because I had, I was a small human at the time. And then eventually I grew into a full-size violin.
Stuck with it.
And now I'm on my 7th violin. And it's so many years later, but I still play the thing. And that introduced me to this whole concept of lifelong learning, which is the second element, is the learning bank. And what I discovered is that through life, we can learn our way out of practically any situation. And now we have these extraordinary tools where we can hold in the palm of our hand the resources of the world, and we can learn about anything as long as we trust the information that we're learning. And so that became the second element of this framework, is health and now learning. And a lifelong learning allows us to get back from setbacks or get out of a situation that we consider to be unpleasant. And I think that the traditional definition of the word antidote is something that is unpleasant or dangerous, right? It gets resolved by an antidote. And so this framework evolved into an antidote for the things that ail us or for the setbacks that we experience in our life.
But the antidote's within us.
The antidote is within us. The abilities are within us for all of these things.
Okay.
So I said to her, health, learning, earning, giving, love, and spirit, a connection to the divine. And I was raised on all of that. So I sent it off to her and I said, I think I've got it. I think I understand why I survived this, because I've, identified this framework of things that have been at work in my life all along. But now I really need them, and they've helped me survive. And she's typical, my mom. You know, what I did was never enough. It was never good enough. And so she said, "These are great, but you're missing one." And I said, "Well, what's that, Mom?" And she said, "Your dream bank." She said, "Without your dreams and your aspiration, you have nothing. It's actually not the last element of the framework. It's the beginning of the framework." I thought I was going to tack on dreams to the end of this whole thing. And she said, "No, it's really central to everything that you do. It is what allows us to get out of bed in the morning, is because you have a dream. It's not fear necessarily. It is your aspiration. And once you aspire to something, then you can be inspired to identify goals and a path. And once you have identified through your inspiration a specific path that you want to travel, then and only then can you sweat it out. And so that's the perspiration. So you have aspiration, inspiration, and then perspiration. And that's the essence of the dream element of the emotional wealth framework."
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that's sort of, we were talking earlier about, you know, where does aspiration come from? Well, I think you've hit it on the head that you have to aspire for something, for some vision of what you see as possible. Otherwise, it doesn't just, I mean, it sounds like you basically always had goal after goal after goal, and now you're trying to do the fastest mile, or sorry, the fastest hour, right? That's your goal, current goal.
Most distance in 1 hour.
Most distance in 1 hour. So he's on a mission right now to do this, what, next year or the year after?
In 2027, okay. I'll turn 70. And at that point, then I'll be in a new age group because the world records are kept in 5-year increments. And I went for this at age 54 because that was an aspiration that I had after a 5-time national champion in 2 sports. And so I had achieved a lot in my life, and I did not need one more medal, you know, from a criterium race or a road race or a rowing race. I decided that I wanted to go for something that was a kind of a career penultimate goal of riding my bicycle the most distance in 1 hour for my age group. And
because
it's a world record.
Yeah,
that's right. And it would also address a national record. If I was able to do that, obviously I would become the national record holder in the same area. So it's a race that's you against you, right? It's you against the clock. Mm-hmm. And there's no other measure for that. It's just distance in 1 hour. And so it took 5 years to train for it. And I had, over that time period, I rode about 15,000 miles a year during that time. And
which is like 3 to 4 hours a day, like 5 days a week. If people want any sort of
that's right.
measure of how much riding that is, it's insane.
And it was not, I was not a stranger to that kind of volume, if you will, in terms of my athletic activities, because I was a amateur and professional cyclist in my teenage years, tipping over just slightly into my early 20s. I had ridden about 400 miles a week over those 10-year period. And some years it was more than that. Pro cyclists ride between 15 and 20,000 miles a year. So for me to put in 15,000 miles a year, I realized that that was probably what I was going to need in order to get myself in my 50s, to get myself back to the US pro level where I could reasonably consider that I might set a world record. If I could set a national record, maybe it would be in the range of a world record. Mm-hmm. So that was my goal. It was a big overarching goal. And I began working with a coach, and I put in the time so that I had a reasonable assumption that I could reach the goal. The problem was that I was in the upper end of my age group, right? And there were plenty of people out there who were trying to do the same thing. So I wound up at my age 54. So I was at the top end of my age group for that. And I wound up riding 26.1 miles in an hour, which was a personal record for me. And it was not a world record. So I was about 3/4 of a second per lap
Sure. Yeah.
off the world record.
Oof.
Okay.
And you were going as hard as you could. No, you had nothing left in the tank,
That's
right? So
right.
you.
Yeah, I had to have somebody help me get my feet off the pedals when I finished that because I had nothing left. So I didn't leave anything out there, and I felt like I had done the very best that I could, and that's what I got. And it was good enough for that day. And I decided that I would do it again. I wasn't sure when I would do it again, but ultimately
When
I
my
had made a choice that I would try again to do it. And 2 years later, I got hit by a car when I was out training. And that was a huge setback that resulted in me discovering, these elements of my life that were already present that I had not relied on. I had not named these elements of my life, but they were there. And if I hadn't been hit by that car, I never would have discovered this. I wouldn't have been forced to discover this. And so I'm grateful for that, that I was the first one who came through the intersection that day, that I took the hit. And I had the physical strength to survive that hit. And it brought me through to not only surviving, but thriving. And I thrived because I had these other things going on in my life.
Well, I mean, I often ask people, what is your life philosophy, and can you even distill that down? I say mine is fluid. Like I'm open to a shifting life philosophy, and I think it mirrors sort of the circumstances I'm in and the era in my life. But having sort of a core kind of foundation, I think, is helpful for someone to kind of it's an inner thing, so no one can take it from you, no matter what's happening out there. You sort of all the things that you talk about in Antidote are no one can take them to you, no one can give them to you, but you essentially develop them within yourself. And we were talking about, can you develop resilience later in life? And I have a lot of respect for Bob because he served in the army and he went through boot camp. And I kind of wish I had gone through a little bit more earlier in life, sort of. I'm very fortunate that I haven't had a lot of setbacks and struggles, but at the same time, I know there's a lot of other people out there like me that the resilience muscle hasn't been necessary to get to where we are in life. So I was just curious your thoughts on should we be out looking for opportunities for grit, like putting ourselves into circumstances that will really test us and are very scary, like. Is that something you've sort of sought out? It sounds like you seek out very uncomfortable ambitions that you're really going to test your resilience.
Yeah, I think that became a pattern for me. And some people say that that's the adrenalated life, that you seek out situations where you're challenged beyond what you think your resources are. And I found myself in those situations frequently. It was often said about me that I would bite off more than I could chew and figure out a way to chew it. And when I was in college, part of the senior year exercise is to write a extensive research paper. I was a student at Princeton at the time, and I was really afraid of nuclear energy. That was something that I didn't know anything about, and I figured that I had resources around me that could teach me about it. And I figured I was a student of urban policy at the time. That was an outgrowth of my interest in architecture. And if we're going to build cities, we need power to drive those cities. And nuclear power was the thing that was being really referred to at the time as unlimited power that we could use as a resource. And they were testing at the time a new type of nuclear reactor that had the capacity to produce plutonium out of uranium. And plutonium is a weapons grade version of uranium. And this particular reactor was funded by the US government, and it was a research project. And I, being in the politics department, I had access not only to engineers in the engineering department, physicists, as well as policy people in the politics department. And so I chose advisors from both of those disciplines to teach me what I needed to know in order to bring some sense to all of that. And that was way out of my comfort zone. So this was an example of me doing exactly that. And I wound up, getting an honors grade on my senior thesis, which we could say was my first 180-page book.
Well, and it doesn't need to be a physical challenge. It can be a
Right.
mental challenge. I think that's an important distinction because we're not all going to seek out the world fastest, hour. And I think that it's comforting to know that you can pick a mental challenge, and maybe it is what scares you in the world, right? Right now, there's a lot of things that are scaring a lot of people, and it's a good opportunity to dive deeper into those and really understand them because you came out of that feeling better about nuclear energy, I assume.
Right.
Because you knew more.
And I nearly charted a career in that because
Okay.
I then had a sense of what was good about it, and balanced that with what I was afraid of.
And Virginia is going to be the nuclear hub, it sounds like. All
Sounds
these
like
data
it.
centers are building their own nuclear reactors. It's kind of crazy.
What came out of all of this was that I realized that we each have a positive balance in each one of these emotional bank accounts that are enumerated in the book. And it comes from our efforts in each of those areas of our life, whether it's learning or earning or giving back or building our love relationships, or having a connection with the divine that has a role, it has a purpose in our own life. And that became a huge resource for me. It is a resource that I have now, and my mission is, if you were to call it that, is to help other people realize that they too have these resources. That we one of the things that I'm beginning to do, as I teach about what's in the book, is we've created a life satisfaction quiz that is called "Are You Wealthy and What Matters?" And we take the seven elements of the emotional wealth framework, and we ask people to look at each element of the emotional wealth framework and give themselves a grade of 1 to 5, how you feel about how you're doing in each of those areas of your life. Are you building good relationships? Have you done the right amount of earning? Do you give back? Do you have a connection to the divine? How are you doing with your dreams? All of those things become a resource for you. And there's some people who come up short. They
The
say,
goal is to
well,
get fives all around the circle,
that's
right?
right. Well, the goal might be to get fives. If
Okay.
that becomes your goal, absolutely. A lot of people give themselves a one, or they say, I feel like I'm in a deficit.
Yeah.
Like, I have in my relationships, I've just been divorced, or I lost my job in my work, or I got downsized out of a job that I intended to have for a long time. And so people suddenly are faced with this assessment of where are you today? And
And others can give you this assessment. I think we've talked about the importance of you having a little bit of a bias as opposed to others being a little more honest. Like maybe our spouses, if we're fortunate, to have a good spouse, they can kind of be honest with us. But I know that's something too you're exploring is this sort of, I know it's been out there, the 360 evaluation, but this is
right.
more at a personal level. You don't need to
Right.
be a CEO and spend big bucks to get this evaluation, right?
Right.
And I think
That's
that's
right.
something we can evolve on your website in the future is give people the ability to go in and anonymously grade you. You get the data, you don't know who it came from, but Imagine how valuable, because you thought you were doing good in the love department, but you know what? You're taking your relationships for granted. And the people feel that. And you wonder why your relationships aren't as strong as they could be.
We think of it as a radical self-kindness, right? It's giving yourself, taking this life satisfaction quiz that, of course, is in the shape of a wheel because I'm a cyclist. And so we've evolved this quiz format to a wheel shape. And we look at the areas of your life where you're doing well by your own assessment. Are you giving yourself a 4 or a 5 in that area? And if that's true, how did you get there? Because I believe that success leaves clues about how we can pattern ourselves on things that were successful for somebody else. And I think it leaves people feeling pretty good when they see that they gave themselves a high score in one particular area of their life. And we look at the resources that it took for them to get there. And then we look at the areas where they gave themselves a low score. And that allows us to then analyze what kind of resources do you think you might use in order to raise that score. If that's a goal for you, is to improve in that area, and maybe 5s, you know, is the ultimate goal that you'd like to have good balance in your wheel of life. And that's kind of where we are now in terms of helping people see that about their own life, that we have a positive balance. It might not be where we want it to be, but we can use certain resources that we have available to us to build that balance, to become more balanced, to have a true north that allows the wheel to roll smoothly.
Before I open it up for questions in the room, Al or Karen, do you guys have any questions for JC? Hi, Karen.
Hi. First of all, thank you for sharing your story. It is really inspirational, and I look forward to reading the book and looking at the framework. My question was, where do you plan on taking on the hour record? Is it T-Town or Rock Hill, or is it out here at Velo Sports Center?
Tell me this again.
It's your husband's up. Hardcore cyclist. So she rattled out a few.
And myself. Okay. I was wondering.
I guess these are venues, right?
Where are you doing the hour record? I assume it's on a track.
So I've ridden about 437,000 miles since 1970. And I rode about a third of those miles, of my lifetime miles, I rode on velodromes.
Yeah. Okay.
So any one of those. You can name, I've probably ridden it.
So where are you doing the hour record?
I've ridden a lot at T-Town. I've probably somewhere in the range of 30 to 50,000 miles that I've spent at T-Town alone.
Nice.
And I was, in fact, I became a national champion there in my 50s.
Very cool.
Where I got a silver medal in the team pursuit.
Nice.
And I also, during that same time frame, I won 5 medals at the regional championship for Virginia, Maryland, and DC.
Nice. Yeah. So did you pick a venue for the hour record?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to go to higher altitude.
Oh, okay.
Because you get an advantage of being at higher altitude of about 1 second per lap if you get up to around 5,000 feet.
Yep.
And the last time that I did this effort, I did it in LA in Carson.
Yeah. Yeah. Velo Sports. At
the track there. And, you know, you're at sea level.
Yep.
And I was only off the world record by 3/4 of a second per lap.
Wow.
So it's possible. Right.
Awesome.
And the conclusion that I came to at the end of that effort was, you know, we wound up here in Carson. At the track, and if we'd gone to altitude, which was the original goal of that particular effort, I was going to go to Aguascalientes in Mexico.
Yep.
And that's where a lot of world records have been set. And when I was a teenager at age 13, I watched Eddy Merckx finish a stage of the Tour de France, and he
Wow.
had just won that stage riding solo at 28 miles an hour. And because kids can get away with stuff, I weaseled my way all the way to the front of that crowd, and I shook his hand
Nice.
because this little kid wanted to be in connection with his energy. And to me, he was a champion. I wanted to be like that. And it was 41 years later, when I was
Wow.
planning to do my world hour record attempt, that I had an opportunity to shake his hand again.
Oh, that's incredible. Great
And
story.
so I practiced up my French, and I brought my one piece skin suit that I was going to wear. I had aerodynamic arms, and everything about the suit was super aerodynamic. And I brought it to this opportunity to meet with him. And I practiced up my French, and I said to him, when I got to shake his hand again, "Will you please sign my jersey over the heart? And I will carry the strength of
Nice.
your heart with me for the hour." And he leaned back and he smiled at me, and he said, "Your French is very good." And he said that in perfect English. And
That's great.
he's Belgian. And so it was all in good humor for him. And he said, "Of course I'll sign your jersey, and I wish you the very best, and I hope you break my record." And that was a lesson for me, is that here's this guy who's not only set the world record for the hour, it's been broken repeatedly over the years, and he even broke his own record because of his extraordinary gift and effort. And here he was telling me, "I hope you break my record."
That's incredible.
So that was it was a
Thanks.
good lesson for me.
Thank you. Yeah, I taught track at the Cleveland Velodrome, so I figured it wasn't going to be Cleveland. It had to be higher altitude. So good luck. We'll be rooting you on.
That's really awesome. That's a
Thanks.
160 meter track.
It's a short one. Yep, short and steep.
Yeah.
Okay, Al. Thanks,
Thanks so much.
Karen. Anything for JCL?
So I agree with the framework. You mentioned being a workaholic, something I can absolutely relate to. And the thing is, when it comes to balance, I've never seen that as something that really has worked in my life, or in I'm an alignment coach. I deal with clients, and I've never seen that. I just have never seen it. Not really. Like, when you're dealing with people who are, highly ambitious, like, there's going to be deficits in certain areas that they're going to want more of. Like, so often people will exceed in the work area, and then it'll cost them in relationships. And so I'm just wondering, what do you do when you have somebody who's, excelling in health, excelling in earning, and then maybe one or two of the other areas they're low at, but if it looks like if they were to spend more time in those areas, it's going to cost them in the areas that are the things that are, that are driving the dream.
Good question, Al.
Right, that's great. We used to ask, how many Californians does it take to change a light bulb? And of course,
Okay.
the answer is, well, first the light bulb has to want to change.
Okay. Got it.
And so I think when I encounter this in my consulting, where we see somebody that comes with a deficit in a certain area, we have to look at, what are your goals, and start there, and then from there, correctly enumerate your goals. Why do you want to get there? And then look back on where you already have assets, right? And this is what eventually brought me to diving deeper into the earning part of your life. Because I was not a saver. I never planned for retirement. I just didn't do a good job of that in my life. And so I had deficit there. And one thing that I learned through my athletic career was that I was coachable. And that made a huge difference for me in the outcomes, right? I made a lot of incremental performance enhancements or performance improvements because I would listen and be coachable. And those became assets for me that I could apply in another part of my life. So I think that's kind of what the way that I use this is, let's look at where you're good and then apply that to your new goal for the area that where you're not good. And raise that up. Let's raise up your balance, because it's not nothing, but what is it? Right? It's something. And so we can then work to multiply that in your life.
Thank you. That was a really good answer. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And sometimes it's the flip side of earning, right? Is we don't just take when we earn, right? Giving back is an element of earning. And because now you have a resource that you can share, and it doesn't necessarily mean that, and we address this in the area of giving, the giving element of the emotional wealth framework, that you don't have to give money. You don't have to necessarily give a physical resource. You can be a mentor, right? And which is what you're talking about. Is mentoring someone to help them improve their life. That's an element of giving that doesn't require cash, you know, maybe just requires a little bit of time. But you've already built this incredible resource in your life because you have experience.
Well, and Al, you make a good point, because I think that in times of my life, I've gone overboard in certain areas at the expense of others. So the giving piece, if I'm too active in the organizations I volunteer for, like I used to do the Writers Conference, it came at such an expense to my business. So my earning took a dive, but my community was over five. Like I would say I was giving too much of that, my time to that. So I backed off from doing that this year so that I can focus back on my business a little more. So there's going to be this kind of constant fluctuation, I think, that happens. And I think you're right. We take things for granted until they become a problem, right? Our bank account's not a problem. We don't pay attention to our bank account until it becomes a problem. And we're like, oh shit, I need to focus on that this month. So I think it's just sort of, you always have to sort of reevaluate where you're at. And you do at the end of each chapter, you sort of ask the reader to sort of do a deep dive and just sort of reflect on, now, where are you today? And those are probably things you need to come back and revisit on a regular basis.
Right. This is really a great opportunity for us. One of my concerns, and I really am grateful to you, Brian, for helping me create a book that is truly useful to people who might read it. And I think the problem with a lot of books is that we read it and we forget it, right? It's really pretty useful to us, but we fail to integrate it into our daily life, into our practice. And so by providing this My Turn section, where you can internalize the ideas and the concepts of each chapter as you go through the book, it gives you an opportunity to then set in place a way to embed these ideas in your own life. How are you doing? How did you see yourself in the story that was presented in this chapter? One of my friends, who's a quite successful author, read the book. And you might have heard
of him. Mention his name.
Yeah, you might have heard of him. His name is Michael Lewis.
Moneyball, The Big Short.
Blindside.
Yeah.
So I sent it to Michael. We were in college together, and we used to hang out. And we were in the same class together at Princeton. And he went off and went into finance and had this amazing career as an author. So I asked him if he would read the book, and he agreed to read the book. And I said, after you read the book, would you talk to me? And he said, yeah, but I'll just warn you, I don't do blurbs, so I'm not going to endorse your book. And I said, yeah, that's fine. He said, I just said, I want to be able to talk with you about it. And he said, the problem with your book is that it's like Brett Favre teaching you to be a quarterback, you know. You have these skills. I've known that since you were in college. You have these incredible physical resources, and your determination is extraordinary. And okay, I get all that. And, you know, it was good feedback from him. But the reality is that because we have this device in the book called My Turn, you can take this framework and you can really use it in your life. The stories are just a vehicle for you to see a way to your own path. And I think that's what I love about how this turned out, you know, because I just had a manuscript when I met Brian.
Now he's got a workbook slash manuscript.
And now we have a downloadable workbook in the Kindle version. And if you get the audio book, it's a downloadable workbook. And so there, and of course, if you buy the print book, you have the book. And it's a way for you to make it your own, which I think is the message of the book. Is not that this just happened to me and I'm not preaching about it. It's that it's an opportunity for us to see the good that's already there in your own life, to see the balance that you have, to work on balances that you feel are low and raise them up to a point where you feel you have more resilience. And that's why we chose the format and the title.
In the room.
I'm curious about the title. And my question, and I'm trying to say this in a positive tone, but why did you put a obvious and deliberately misspelled word in the title?
Right, because you just brought it up, and that's the reason I did that.
But it immediately eroded my confidence when I saw it.
Yeah,
and it so, took away the trust.
Did it?
in the content when it starts with an obvious gimmicky misspell.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious as to your thinking of doing that.
One of the things that Sam Horn, who was my original book coach before she introduced me to Brian, my publisher, is that marketing messages should be pithy. They should be original and they should be purposeful. In other words, marketing messages should pop. And when your eyebrows go up and you look at something a second time,
there's an anomaly. There's something off.
It's an anomaly. Mm-hmm. And so this is a combination of the word wealth or wellness.
I got it.
And so I don't have to explain it to you. But the point is, how many people have called me and said, hey, wait, you have a typo on the cover. And I said, exactly. And you remembered that word. And so in a way, yes, it's a gimmick, but at the same time, it's a way for us to think about the positive combined with an element from the framework.
You know, he's got health, wealth, learning wealth, and it's spelled W-E-L-L-T-H in every case, earning wealth, giving wealth, and it's a take on wellness. Yeah, you got it. No, it's a good point.
I got it, but
it threw you. We chose
no,
to trade.
No, it. What it did was it caused me to it hit at the trust factor of the content when I see something like that, because I knew immediately what it was.
Right.
And but the other thing that I'd like to ask about, and this goes to a lot of your stories, and that is that it seems that your strength comes out of challenges. And Brian, you make a point of taking risks and that type of stuff. But it is, you know, the expression is never waste a perfectly good disaster. And it seems that you have practiced that all the way through. And you seem to want to try to figure some way to avoid all those disasters.
And I have successfully till now,
but it's about that. It's about the balance of that risk taking that I'd like you to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem to have done a really good job of not wasting your perfectly good disasters.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, Kipling said, we must be broken in order to build anew.
Right.
Right. We can't get to that higher plateau without a struggle. And same is true in the life of Jesus. If we look at that, you know, we exalt Jesus for not for his victories, but for his incredible challenges that he overcame. And at the same time, I think that is our crucible. Once you have made that paradigm shift, then life is not going to deal fairly to you. Things are not going to go okay, right? Don't worry, nothing is going to be all right. And secondly, that my mother loved to say was, remember, we're all in this alone. And you know, at first you would think, wow, JC, you had a pretty awful childhood. You know, And not only is nothing going to be okay, but we're all in this alone. And what she really meant, and eventually what I learned, was that you're responsible for your thread of the great fabric of the universe, right? And but that thread of your life is connected to all of us, mm-hmm. right? And so we are really a part of something greater than us that allows us to have strength when we're knocked down. At the same time, we want to be strong as we can be. And what I learned was that by challenging myself, I could grow. And in athletic parlance, it's called peak plateau. So you push yourself with the same workout every day for a week, a month, whatever length of time it is, and you develop a mental determination that allows you to do that and continue going. Especially in cycling, you know, you'll certainly validate this. And then suddenly you're doing the same thing day after day, and now you're up at a new peak. Well, how did that happen? It's because that's the classic way that we grow. The same thing is true in business. We can continue doing the same thing. We're going along. And then something magical happens, right? Like Steve Jobs said, you know, where the great idea meets a mass market, right?
Your timing. What Bob says, it's one of the three T's, right?
Timing,
one of the
important timing.
Things. Or one of the luck is, well, luck right. and timing, that go hand.
And Malcolm Gladwell talks about this.
And talent. And
in Blink and in Tipping Point and Outliers. Those are you know, three of his probably best known books, but especially in Outliers, you know, it's the rule of 10,000 hours. And I realized when I turned 49 that I wanted to go for this world record thing because I had done everything else in cycling, right? And I still wanted to challenge myself to do something in my adult life. And so I went down that path. And it took me 5 years to get to enough volume in my adult life where I could reasonably pursue the world hour record. But I had to use that same phenomenon of continuing to do what you're doing today, and then suddenly you're up at a new level of performance. Mm-hmm. And it's the way that the world is wired, that through obstacles, we are able to triumph. And without obstacles, we just muddle along in the no wake zone.
Well, you figure out what doesn't work, right? In business, a lot of it is just finding out, well, that didn't work. And you eliminate more and more things that
did
don't work.
Did it not work, or was it one of the steps along the process?
I think that's the correct assessment right there.
Okay.
It's a step along the path. It's not necessarily a failure. I don't believe in failure.
Yeah, I know. I love that. You either learn or you succeed.
No, you either succeed or you learn.
That's right. I think in the chapter on learning wealth, you know, we have this this paradigm. Was it learning? Where do we have the rethink?
You have to watch your time. And...
Yeah, we're right at the hour. But while you're looking for that, Rick, you've been quiet. Any last questions? Not long ones, but.
No, I enjoy these because I place myself and determine where I have deficiencies and where I don't in these. It's education, and I appreciate this. I may have several deficiencies.
Actually, it's earning.
It's earning. Yeah. Okay, that's it. Yeah.
And he has a flywheel and it's sort of this recurring thing in business. I think because you talk about, you blend some of them. I was noticing this morning that you definitely touch on, that's the little... graphic in
so
there.
That's it, and you'll have an opportunity to read this, but it's the innovation cycle in business, which allows you to fail fast. You think about a new problem, you confront it, you come up with a solution, you go, hey, we got it, and you realize it's not optimized, it's not working. And so what we learn in life is that it's not about the things that you necessarily hold on to. It's your ability to let go of the things that aren't working.
Mm.
And I think that's something we can apply very broadly in our life, but especially in business, is that is the innovation cycle of failing fast, finding a new solution, testing it out in the marketplace, finding out what elements of that new solution work, integrating those into the new product, and then continuing to do that process. And as you iterate that process, these are the agile companies that are the most valuable companies in our economy today, are the ones who continually innovate, and that becomes the culture of their company. And because I've spent my career in early stage enterprise, I wanted that to be a part of this, you know, of the Learning Wealth chapter.
All right, guys, well, we're at an hour. If you want to learn more, JC's website is antidotethebook.com. It is available Kindle, audiobook, where JC narrates it himself, and paperback, and hardcover is coming out shortly. But you reach out to him through the website, and he actually is adding a lot of resources. I think we'll set up that quiz so that people, I really think that would be valuable, okay, to allow other people to anonymously give you. So keep an eye out for that. That'll be added shortly. And otherwise, we really appreciate you being a part of this. And if you didn't join us live, be sure to keep an eye out on the meetup for our next Tech Reads, where we'll bring in another author and you can ask questions if you attend in person. So thank you, Karen and Al. Appreciate you both.
Thank you.
Keep learning and keep working.
Likewise. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Tech Reads, sponsored by Softech. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or want to suggest an author for a future episode, visit Softech at softec.org and click on the Tech Reads link.